And welcome to the Rob Call Bottom Up Radio Show, WNJC 1360 AM out of Washington Township, reaching Metro Philly and South Jersey, sponsored by opednews.com. My guest tonight is Michael McRae. He's an attorney, the author of Race, Power, and Politics, and one of the organizers of the Whistleblower Summit for Civil and Human Rights, which gives out the Pillar Award. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob, and congratulations on you winning your Pillar this year. And I'm glad that I'm here with you tonight.
It's a real honor. Thank you. So, I'd like to start off with you telling your story. You've been involved with the whistleblower community for a good number of years. What's your personal story that got you involved with whistleblowers and the whistleblowing community?
Sure, Rob. When I tell my story, I often tell people that I start off with a funny thing happened to me on my way to Wall Street. I have a background in finance and accounting, and I was one of these guys that was, I wanted to go to Wall Street, really, in the 1990s. I graduated from Florida A&M University, and I went to law and business school. I went to Georgetown Law, and I was over in the Howard business program. But while I was studying, you know, my governor ran for president. I'm originally from Arkansas, actually one of the most underserved communities in America. My hometown got rated the worst metropolitan area to live in for 2 years in a row. So we were back to back.
Wow.
But anyway, so I had a lot of empathy for the people and, in dealing with underserved communities like my own. So I got the opportunity to work as a student organizer for the Clinton campaign in 1992. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, my governor won. He became president. And so what happened is when the Clinton administration came to Washington, I started to work with what was a new program back then, and it was called the Federal Empowerment Zones Programs, EZEC, that stood for Empowerment Zones and Enterprise Communities. It's kind of a passe now, but at that point in time, it was a $4 billion appropriations, and it was actually the largest community development package since since Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society programs. So it was a White House initiative, and it was being administered jointly by HUD, USDA, and actually HHS. And so I was one of the people that was working on the rural side over at USDA on this White House initiative. And during the course of that, for me, it was great. So I was kind of working for the administration in the daytime, and I was going to law and business school at night. And I had the dubious pleasure of visiting the worst places in America to live. You know, that was a part of my job. But what I did, what I grew to learn and appreciate was that economic development allowed me to do everything that I thought I wanted to do on Wall Street. I mean, we had community development banks. We had new markets tax incentives. There was all these programs that were designed to develop underserved communities, which was really what I wanted to be involved in. So, you know, as you know, the laws are the same whether you're financing, you know, Trump Towers or your local grocery store. So I was so pleased to be able to contribute and give back and use the skills that I thought I was going to use on Wall Street to helping to build and develop these underserved communities like my hometown. And during the course of this, Rob, I discovered that there was $40 million that was about to get pumped into this nonprofit down in Mississippi. And the community, I knew for a fact that the application wasn't grant worthy. So entity that I knew didn't have the financial controls in place, the internal management structures. You know, this was about to be a big government boondoggle. And I had the courage or the temerity to speak up, probably the naivete, to speak up against this level of government, you know, waste, fraud, and abuse. And that's how I became a federal whistleblower. That decision there basically changed the course of my, you know, my professional career, changed my life really entirely. And I started this. Now it's been a, you know, 18-year running battle with the USDA, and actually I'm still fighting it to this very day. But as a result of my blowing the whistle and kind of losing my federal career, I decided to become active in the First Amendment, to become a First Amendment advocate and to become active in the whistleblowing community. So I decided I wasn't going to be a victim. I wanted to become an advocate. And so with that, we started to have these conferences about 7 or 8 years ago. It was originally known as Washington Whistleblowers Week, and it was the first time that whistleblowers from around the country kind of had the guts, the courage to come together as a community and to organize a conference on Capitol Hill and to make demands and to talk about, you know, the state of what was going on and why we need more whistleblower protections. And, you know, we became a lively community. So the first year, you know, no one really expected anything to happen because it had never been done before. And it was a huge success. You know, we had NGOs and individual whistleblowers and different public citizens of the public. I mean, everybody came, and it was a tremendous success. And from time to time, each year, different groups in our coalition will sponsor a conference that we have. And usually it's in May. But this year we kind of moved it to July because we're also looking forward for the enactment of National Whistleblower Appreciation Day. But anyway, long and short of it is, so we've been having these conferences, and I've been involved in organizing and planning, I guess, the first 2 years and then the last 3 years. So I've been heavily involved in about 5 out of 8 of these conferences. And so it went off. It was a tremendous success, which I think, Rob, you can attest to. But, you know, we had it on the Hill, lots of great attention. International press showed up. RT America, which is, I think, the second largest international broadcaster, covered it. You know, we had a great time. And so that's kind of how I got involved in the whistleblower as a whistleblower advocate. And based upon that, I had an experience with ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. And that's the subject of my book. And so how I got involved in that is, after I lost my federal job, I started to work for a small minority-owned development company down in Georgia, actually in Atlanta. And we basically acquired an old historic hotel. It was called the Wyckoff Hotel, and it's actually on Peachtree Street, catty corner from the Ritz-Carlton. Now, when we acquired the hotel in 1998-1999, downtown Atlanta was in such a state of blight. You know, it was banned. And again, Atlanta actually had an empowerment zone, which was one of the reasons I was familiar with the area and the project. I mean, this was the federal program that I worked on. Now I was looking at it from the eyes of a small business person, business owner that was trying to do business with the city. Long and short of it is, we're able to come up with innovative financing scheme, a plan that involved using historic tax credits, new markets tax credits, and assembling the air rights over the MARTA station that was next door to it. In fact, it was so innovative and so creative, our plan was good enough to steal, which is exactly what happened to us. And we became the victim of an early stage of mortgage fraud. It's actually commercial mortgage fraud down in Atlanta. I mean, when you can literally steal a hotel that's actually on the National Historic Register, and that really lets you know how bad the system has become. And so during that fight, I started to approach some of the other civil rights organizations. We went to the NAACP. They basically didn't return our phone calls. We went to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. They helped a lot, but they were able to be intimidated by some of the local political power structure. And we also went to ACORN. And I wrote the book is about my experiences on the inside with ACORN when we were fighting mortgage fraud in Georgia. And so what happened then was, I joined ACORN.
I have to tell you, Michael, that the book is really well written.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
I haven't gotten through the whole book yet, but what I've read, it is riveting. It really is. And you've done a great job as a writer putting together a powerful story here.
Well, Rob, my goal with the book is because a lot of people prior to 2008, you know, most people, if you weren't really into civil rights and grassroots organizing, you probably never heard of ACORN. And a lot of people really don't even think about what community organizing actually was. And so kind of my point was, what I was hoping to do was to give people kind of a bird's eye look at ACORN through the eyes of not somebody who wanted to hurt ACORN, but actually somebody who wanted to save ACORN. Our goal after I started working on the board and whatnot, it was disclosed that there was a multi-million-dollar embezzlement And Marcel Reed was a board member with me at the time, and she wanted help trying. She was placed on this on a committee within Acorn to reform the organization and to investigate the embezzlement. By this point in time, actually, my Acorn chapter actually had been dissolved, and so I wasn't on the board at the time of the embezzlement. But Marcel remembered me and my expertise, and she came to me for help. And so, and that was because she knew I was active in the whistleblower community, and she also knew I had a background in finance and accounting. And so when she came to me, we started to work together, and we brought in, you know, professional companies, PR firm. There was a low-income credit union that had agreed to help us. We reached out to Ernst & Young. I mean, we're really about to go in and kind of go soup to nuts and revamp and reform Acorn at the time to get rid of any type of financial malfeasance and anybody who was involved in the embezzlement or participated in it. And then what happened there was, so Marcel and the group that was known as the Acorn Eight, they were the real Acorn whistleblowers, and they weren't these guys that were, you know, James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles, you know, the folks that dressed up like a fake pimp and prostitute and basically engaged in trickery, skullduggery. But these were people that were really there for the right reason, that were actually trying to save the organization. The problem was when they got rid of the founder and his brother, the chief financial officer, that would be Wade Rafke and Dale Rafke, but they never removed the layers of staffers that were subservient to those guys. And what happened was senior staff resisted the efforts to reform the organization. And I can only say this, is that had we been successful with our efforts to clean the house of Acorn, the right would not have been able to basically implode it. And so that's kind of the lesson from, you know, about whistleblowers is, you know, we're the canaries we're the canaries in the coal mine, and if you listen to us, we can avoid a lot of problems. And so that's kind of the tie-in between
I'm glad you enjoyed it. Let's stop there a minute and let's talk about what is a whistleblower. What makes somebody a whistleblower? Are there like definitions for what a whistleblower is? And I'm asking you first to give a definition because a week or two ago, you wrote an article questioning whether Bradley Manning and Ed Snowden are whistleblowers. So what is a whistleblower first?
Okay, Rob, and really, I give my personal definition. So, again, I'm not an authority, but it's whatever credibility that I have on the matter. I put this behind it, and we actually have these conversations often in our communities at the Whistleblower Summit. You know, what is a whistleblower is something that we talk about every year. But my personal definition of a whistleblower is somebody who's on the inside, who has access to information that exposes him or herself to loss. He has skin in the game based on an effort to try to call out wrongdoing, and he does it with clean hands. So the key elements are, you know, legitimate access to information, basically pure motives, and clean hands themselves. And so by that definition, I distinguish being a whistleblower from, for instance, being an activist. For instance, when we talk about the Acorn situation, you know, Marcel Reed and the people that were fighting the embezzlement, they were whistleblowers. Now, James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles, they were conservative activists. I mean, they weren't whistleblowers because they weren't inside the organization. They actually didn't have really any accurate information, and basically they engaged in a demonstration. But if you're on the right and you didn't like Acorn, they have a lot of fans. You know, to me, it being a whistleblower is much more noble than that. But again, they're activists. And then there's also the distinction I draw with what a publisher is, in the sense that Andrew Breitbart, in the Acorn example, was a publisher of big government. He promoted these doctored and edited videos. Again, publishers have a special place in America because the First Amendment really protects publishers. You know, we say that people have a right to know, but the way the First Amendment works, it's really that publishers have a right to publish. And so it's through those avenues is where we get the free, you know, the information and the free exposition of information that may be detrimental to the government. So there's nothing wrong with saying that somebody's a publisher or activist versus a whistleblower. But in my definition, I kind of reserve the title, the moniker whistleblower, to a subset of people. And those are the people that try to do things the right way. They're forced to, they may be forced to go outside the normal bounds because they face internal resistance. They're usually not doing it for personal gain. For instance, if we talk about, you know, Sammy the Bull Gravone, You know, he's not a whistleblower. You know, he was a hitman who basically turned state's evidence against the Gambino family and John Gotti because, you know, he got caught. You know, yeah, he gave up information and it was useful for the prosecution of a crime family, but I don't call him a whistleblower. You know, he was an informant. And so I kind of draw those distinctions. And then also in the case when we're talking about Snowden and Manning, there's some people, a true whistleblower, once he identifies wrongdoing, you know, he goes about trying to right a specific wrong. It's not that, you know, you get access to millions of classified documents and you release a whole database. That doesn't make you a whistleblower. Now, you may be an activist because you believe, for instance, in the case of Manning, Bradley Manning, you may feel strongly about you're on a moral position that the war is wrong and you want to do something about it. But just because you release classified documents doesn't make you a whistleblower. Now, if you knew that out of those millions of documents or whatever, there were 10 cases where, you know, there was unjustified, you know, drone strikes or somebody was killed or, you know, if there was specific wrongdoing within those documents and then you leaked only the wrongdoing, in my opinion, that would make you a whistleblower because you have to have some sense of social responsibility about this stuff. But to indiscriminately release millions of classified documents, again, I would say that you're an activist. You may do it for what you believe is a good cause, but in my book, that doesn't make you a whistleblower. That makes you more of a leaker.
But, you know, I wonder, with all those documents, who would have known that a message from a diplomat commenting on the dictator president of Tunisia would have started the Arab Spring and a revolution there?
Right. Well,
sometimes just and it seems to me that Bradley Manning in releasing what he did has made massive changes happen in the world. Huge, massive changes affecting hundreds of millions, if not billions of people. And
absolutely. I'm very clear with you on that, Rob. He's definitely an activist, and there's no doubt about it. And again, I don't think some people get mad, and I think that was part of the feedback that I got from the article that I wrote about this, actually on the Op-Ed News. But I'm not, again, I hold all three classes of people. I hold publishers in high esteem. I hold whistleblowers in high esteem. I hold activists in high esteem. I mean, I do all three. So again, I'm very clear about it. I'm not saying that as a pejorative on anyone. I just draw distinctions, and it's probably to me because to me there's a certain moral force that also goes along with blowing the whistle that I don't think the other categories necessarily have. Not to say that there's anything wrong with them. So I definitely agree with you that Bradley Manning did. He accomplished a lot. I agree that he's an activist. I agree that he was he ignited a lot of change around the globe. But would I call him a whistleblower? I don't go that far.
Okay. So what do you call him? Just an activist?
Yeah, I would say Bradley Manning is an anti-war activist. I believe Edward Snowden was a whistleblower. I have questions about some of the after when he blew the whistle on PRISM and the metadata program, that was definitely whistleblowing. Now, this stuff about him leaving the country and giving up other secrets and trying to get, basically finding a country that he can call home, I'm troubled by that because I think I believe that he changed from being a whistleblower to it's a little bit more problematic in the aftermath now. But I think Edward Snowden, clearly his initial disclosures were clearly whistleblowing.
Now, Daniel Ellsberg, perhaps the most famous whistleblower in America, has said that Snowden could not have done what he did and stayed in the United States and remained free like he did.
Yeah, well, no, and that, to be honest, Rob, that's the only hesitation that I have about when I take issue with Snowden's subsequent actions is I know for a fact that there are no protections for national security whistleblowers. So I believe that what happened was Snowden kind of placed himself between a rock and a hard place. And I know that there are a lot of some of the congressional people have come out and said that, wow, he could have just blown the whistle to Congress and, you know, he didn't have to do what he did. You know, that's actually not correct. I mean, that's, you know, basically it's a lie. National security whistleblowers really have no protections, and that is the conflict that I have in dealing with the Snowden situation. If there were stronger protections in the WPEA, the Whistleblower Protection and Enhancement Act, or the military version of the WPEA, then it would be clear to me that he had an effective mechanism to blow the whistle legally, and he should not have done that. But I think that, you know, when you know that the national security state is such that you have no protections and you decide that you want to basically commit an act of civil disobedience, are we saying that you have to subject yourself to possibly lifetime imprisonment or death, or is it fair that you be allowed to abscond the country to try to, to preserve the most basic liberty, and that's life? So it kind of puts you into a legal conundrum, in my opinion.
So you say that national security whistleblowers have no protections.
They really effectively.
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, what we're saying is that at least you have in all other forms or most other forms of whistleblowing, you know, there are statutes and there are rights that you have, certain apparel rights. You get access in some instances, you get access to a trial by jury. In other instances, you go before perhaps the Merit Systems Protection Board. But what I'm saying is that the way our defense policy is written is there are all these exclusions based upon if you're dealing with the defense or the national security apparatus. And ultimately what happens is they gut all the rights that other classes of whistleblowers have. And so you're really left effectively with no real protections at all.
So what are some other kinds of whistleblowers besides national security whistleblowers, just to be clear for the listeners and readers?
You know, Robin, that was one of the things that when I first started going to the conferences, you know, I learned a lot. You know, well, the first thing that you learn is that you've got to be connected, because the first tool of any system, whether it's the government or corporations, is they isolate you. And isolation is actually the worst thing that happens to whistleblowers, because, you know, they'll drive away your friends and, you know, you lose your status in society. You know, you may lose the respect of your family. I lost my fiance. You know, and it's a way to drag you really into depression and worse. So the first thing that you learn when you start to come to the conferences, to the Whistleblower Summit, is that you find other people that have gone through similar experiences. And we've basically created a mutual support network where I may be able to recommend a counselor for you, or you might be mentored by another whistleblower. We may find other organizations that can help you. We may be able to refer you to good attorneys. So that part is almost a very cleansing and almost a life-affirming aspect of participating in the Whistleblower Summit. And one of the early things that I noticed was that there are different flavors of whistleblowers and there are different rules. So what, like for instance, some people that blow the whistle on civil rights issues, you know, Title VII, Title VI, and Title VII claims, you know, there are certain rules and regulations that go along with filing under those statutes, which are different from someone in, for instance, a national security paradigm, where you actually have very little protection, or someone in law enforcement. Somebody in a command and control environment, the law is actually different, so there are different considerations when they blow the whistle. Or perhaps somebody who's in normally in the federal government that doesn't have a, you know, a Title VI or VII claim, but just blows the whistle and winds up going to the MSPB. So there are different rules that are associated with, you know, dealing with the Merit Systems Protection Board and going to the Office of Special Counsel. You know, there's a whole other flavor of whistleblowers that are the judicial reformers. And for me, those are like some of the most impressive whistleblowers, because when you're blowing the whistle on the courts, I mean, the judges represent the true power in America. And so those people have to be very, very careful with whenever you're dealing with blowing the whistle on judicial corruption or misconduct. So there's not an unlimited variety, but there's a variety of different communities where people blow the whistle and their rules. And again, even in a nonprofit environment, there are very different rules versus when you're blowing the whistle in the public sector versus private sector. The rules are different. Also in the corporate versus nonprofit sector. So there's all these different species of whistleblowers.
So it sounds so. Last week I spoke with Tom Devine, one of the leading defenders of whistleblowers, through the Government Accountability Project, and And he basically said they've made some great progress recently with legislation and laws that protect some whistleblowers. And those are primarily private sector whistleblowers and government employees. But then he also said that with one hand, Obama is giving something to them. With the other hand, he's attempting to declare that just about all government employees are in security positions. So things are certainly not perfect yet, that's for sure.
Oh, no. And I mean, this has been, to be honest, Rob, this has been the tension since the founding of the country. I mean, again, as you were at the summit, you know, the first whistleblower protection law, well, the worst whistleblower law was written by the Continental Congress in 1778. So to me, when I look at whistleblowing, I view it as an act of patriotism. You know, it ties into the First Amendment, and this basically the founding fathers wanted to give the people the right to fight back against a tyrannical government. And so it's as, you know, whistleblowing is as American as apple pie. What Tom was kind of referring to is, Tom had fought for 13 years to pass the Whistleblower Protection and Enhancement Act. And, you know, through his efforts, through the efforts of the Make It Safe Coalition, through all the whistleblower groups that had assembled and supported the legislation, you know, we finally got that passed last year, which it gave, again, it's not a panacea, there's still holes in it, but it was the basic, it was the most, it was an advancement in whistleblower protections and rights. You know, the greatest advancement probably definitely in over a decade. Now, what has happened again since then in this last year is that the current administration has created, I think it was an executive order, but essentially what they did was they expanded the definition of national security, which as we just spoke about a little while ago, national security whistleblowers really have no protections. What they have done is they have reclassified any government function has the possibility of being declared national security. So, for instance, you know, if the Obama administration says that, you know, protecting the food supply is an important interest to national security, now people at USDA are now national security whistleblowers and therefore unprotected. So on one hand, we fight for, you know, for 12, 13, you know, 14 years to pass a new law, and we finally get it passed, and you know, basically through an executive order, we're in a situation where all the benefits may just be taken away. And so that's why we have to always be vigilant, and we have to always be active. So you can never sleep. And that's why even though we passed the law last year, that's why we still had to come to Capitol Hill this year to make sure that the implementation of that law is as aggressive and as positive as the law itself. Because if we don't, you know, look at the Supreme Court. You know, we're literally turning back the clock on 50 years worth of civil rights advances, you know, with, you know, the stroke of a pen.
Mm. These are scary times.
Yes, they are.
You have some interesting people giving blurbs for your book. John Fund and Glenn Beck, they're right-wingers.
Right.
What's the story with that?
Yeah, well, Rob, understand, I mean, again, you were at the summit. So what happens with whistleblowing, we don't view it through a partisan lens. As a matter of fact, our community calls whistleblowing transpartisan because, I mean, we gave a Pillar Award to Senator Grassley, you know, Senator Rand Paul for what they did in terms of human rights. And we've also given Pillar Awards to Marcia Fudge, the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, and, you know, Maxine Waters didn't get a pillar, but, you know, it's a place where our community includes the far left, the far right, and libertarians. You know, liberals, conservatives, progressives, libertarians, everybody agrees with whistleblowing because whistleblowing is about right versus wrong versus left versus right. And in terms of the blurbs by Glenn Beck and all, you know, when the Acorn story hit, we were Acorn whistleblowers, and unfortunately, I mean, we tried to tell our story everywhere. We were on Fox News, we were on CNN. You know, we were, you know, for us, it wasn't a partisan exercise. It was interesting to us in the sense that Glenn Beck was one of the first people to really kind of push the issue, to give us a platform or whatnot when we were basically getting shut out by some of the, I won't say liberal media, but some of the mainstream media, I guess, we were having difficulty getting airtime. So Glenn Beck was one of the first people to really let us tell our story. And again, you know, he had a certain slant that we didn't ascribe to, but we did appreciate the opportunity to, you know, to tell the truth, or at least to tell our truth. And so,
what was your truth with regarding to Acorn that attracted?
There was a multi-million-dollar embezzlement, and that we were demanding that there be a independent audit, a forensic examination, an independent audit, and anybody who was associated with the embezzlement needed to be terminated. I mean, we were very clear, and our message was truth and transparency. You know, a lot of times a lot of the people on the right, or a lot of some of Glenn Beck's audience, they wanted to get into issues of voter fraud and all this other stuff. But no, we were very self-contained, and we were very responsible with our advocacy. We didn't go, you know, we weren't going to go out on a limb. For us, it was difficult. It was frustrating because people would use our story, and again, we were telling the truth. We were speaking truth to power, but they would try to say that, well, that means that all this other stuff about Acorn is a boogeyman and all that other stuff is bad. Now, we were very careful to be very clear as to what we were saying and what we weren't saying, and a lot of people commented on us that, you know, we didn't let Glenn Beck put words in our mouth, but he did allow us to have a platform to get our word out. And so from that perspective, we're like, look, we're speaking truth to power, but we're telling, you know, we're telling an uncomfortable truth about clearly a multi-million-dollar embezzlement. So we always stood on firm ground. And, you know, whoever welcomed us to spread that message, you know, we went for, whether they were, you know, Fox News or CNN.
Right. And the fact is that it's a tragedy that Acorn, which had grown to be such a big organization advocating for the poor and for justice, was corrupted. And between all the problems it had, it lost the support that it had.
Right, right. Well, I mean, the Acorn story is a cautionary tale. And again, a little, you know, self-interest plug or whatnot, you know, read Race, Power, and Politics, and you'll kind of see an insider's view of what was really going on, because a lot of people don't really understand the dynamic of Acorn or wonder how Acorn got to be so powerful. And again, I was on the board, I received the training, and I think I have the only book out that talks about Acorn from that point of view. And again, we're not naysayers, we're Acorn supporters, but there was some wrongdoing, and Acorn actually needed reform. And it was unfortunate that the way it came, the way that reform came, there were better ways to do it.
Well, the book really gives a fascinating insider view of the challenges of an activist organization and how brave people try to do the right thing, too. So I want to ask you another question. In the article announcing the recipients of the Pillar Award, a number of people questioned giving the award to Rand Paul. So What's your story there? Why did Rand Paul receive this award?
Oh, very clearly, Rand Paul received the award for his stance for Internet privacy. And then also, the stand with Rand, his filibuster against these unlawful drone strikes, really possibly against Americans overseas. I mean, again, the Pillar Award, it's really a human rights award. And so clearly Rand Paul was not being honored for his civil rights record because, you know, he's against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But, we thought that in our world right now, especially with the situation with domestic surveillance and, the Snowden effect and all of that, that the people that are standing up for Internet privacy, and again, the whistleblowers are probably the most sensitive people other than actual terrorists, because, you know, the government is reading our emails and we face severe retaliation. So the reason that Rand Paul received his award, in addition to Ron Wyden, was for their stance against unlawful domestic surveillance, for Internet privacy, and then in Rand's case, also for his stand against these unlawful drone strikes. Now, mind you, you know, Chuck Grassley received a Pillar Award previously for his basically a Lifetime Achievement Award for his support of whistleblowers, you know, through the ages. I mean, Senator Chuck Grassley is like the patron saint for whistleblowers. And then we were also proud that, of course, you received your award for all the remarkable work you're doing here with Bottoms Up Radio and with Op-Ed News, which for us is the go-to platform to get whistleblower stories out. We also gave a pillar this year to Marcia Fudge. She received hers for her civil rights record, and she actually was the first African-American to actually receive a pillar award. So we're very proud of Representative Fudge as well. So the selection committee chooses the pillars. It's broad. We're even-handed. Again, we don't look at whistleblowing at all from a partisan lens. I think your readership may be a little bit more liberal or progressive than our community is, which always makes, you know, reading my, like, if you read my articles, you know, there's always going to be some type of conflict there. But again, I'm approaching stuff from the whistleblower right and wrong perspective. I'm not dealing with it through a partisan lens.
So whistleblower legislation has received bipartisan support then?
Absolutely. And really, I mean, you have to have bipartisan support, Rob, because it'll never get passed. You know, if you think about it, whether it's the WPEA or WPA, you know, there's going to be, you know, you got to get sponsors, you got to get people to, you know, sponsor the bill, you need co-sponsors, you got people have to vote. So, again, you know, everybody tends to be against waste, fraud and abuse in the government. You know, that's not really a partisan issue. You know, mismanagement is mismanagement, wrongdoing is wrongdoing. So we're able to find support, and I think that's one of the ways that we're able to be effective because, look, we give credit where credit's due, on the left and the right. To be perfectly honest, Rob, I was a little surprised this year that the right didn't support the conference as much as they have in previous years. So a lot of people that were scheduled to be speakers kind of didn't show. So that was the only thing that was kind of a little bit disturbing this year. Other than that, we had a wonderful whistleblower summit for civil and human rights, and we're looking forward to next year.
Well, we'll be helping to keep people aware of what's going on with it, and Op-Ed News is always happy to help and eager to help the whistleblower community. I personally believe that whistleblowers are an essential part of a democracy, and they work with a free press to maintain democracy, and I'm very worried, really, about the way the Obama administration has so aggressively gone after whistleblowers and attempted to turn them into criminals.
Right. Well, it's worse than that, Rob. I mean, you've really got the case where, I mean, for the